Okay, good morning, everybody. This is Bio241, and it is Thursday, the 5th of September. Yes, indeed it is. So let's take a look at the schedule. Okay, so the 5th, we're going to finish up chemistry, chapter 2 today. And after today, you should have all of the pre-lecture reading assignment keys available for you to check your pre-lecture reading assignment work that you did. All right, and that is really helpful to students, even though I'm not grading it. Please do that so that you keep in tune with what we're doing in lecture. So start working on chapter 6 when you get home. Okay, so let's come to order back there, because there might be interfering with some other students that are trying to listen right behind you. Okay, so let's see, when is our first exam? The 24th of September. So that is going to be, still 2 weeks away from Tuesday coming up. But nonetheless, there's a lot of material in here, so you got to start preparing and studying as if the test is going to be next week. All right, so don't get behind in here. The first test is going to cover chapters 1, 2, 3, and 6. Okay, here's the sign-in sheet, same one that you signed last time, and it's in the same state it was last time. If your name isn't on there and you're registered, it's still that way. But on next week, I'll have the official sign-in sheet. Okay, please don't sign the sign-in sheet and then leave class. Okay, because you're signing that sheet saying that you're here for the entire class period and participating. That's what you mean by if you're attending class or not, right? So if you sign that sheet and then leave, then you're falsifying information for me. And guess what? That's a grounds for me to drop you, okay? So don't ever falsify any information. Okay, if you got to leave early, then make a note or let me know. But if you have to leave early, you won't be given credit for being here, okay? Okay, so anybody got a question about the schedule? Everybody can get into Blackboard, and why is that important? Why is that really important, especially today? Because you do have a deadline tonight at 11 p.m., right? And it's not just for one quiz, it's for two quizzes, the first 2 weeks. So make sure you get both of those weeks done, and you're in good shape. And who's 3 weeks ahead? Anybody 3 weeks ahead in here, or 1 week ahead? 3 weeks, so 1, 2, 3, excellent, guess what? You're never going to miss an assignment if you keep that up, because you'll never miss a deadline if you stay 1 week ahead of schedule. So that is really, really, really good. Okay, something that I did this week is that I paired your Blackboard sections to the e-textbook, the electronic form of your textbook, so you can go into tools. If we have time, maybe I'll show you how that's done. You have a registration code in the custom book package that you bought, and you can put that in. It tells you how to register, and you have access to the e-book, the e-textbook as well. And also you have access to Anatomy Revealed, and that's a virtual dissection program. It'd be really more helpful for an anatomy class, but since anatomy is a prerequisite for this one, it probably will help students a lot. It gives you really nice three-dimensional pictures of anatomy. So when you register your textbook, so you get the e-textbook, that privilege comes along with it. I'm sure you're going to have fun looking and working with that website. Maybe I'll use it at certain times during the semester as well. Okay, but usually I don't spend a whole lot of time with anatomy because you guys know that stuff already. All right, so last time we were talking about proteins, and we started talking about important biological molecules. What are the four main classes of important biological molecules? Carbohydrates. Lipids, nucleic acids, and proteins. Yeah, and not in any specific order, but that's good. So you should know the building blocks. What's the building block of a complex sugar or a polysaccharide? A monosaccharide. Yeah, monosaccharide. And we put two monosaccharides together to form a disaccharide. And how does your body do that? Dehydration synthesis reaction. Yeah, so speak those things out, because that's one important way that you can learn relatively easily if you talk about the subject, right? Because that activates so many centers in your brain, it makes learning a lot easier. Okay, so what's the building block of a protein? Amino acid. And to make a protein, what kind of reaction is used in your body? dehydration synthesis reaction, exactly the same one. What about to break a protein down to its building blocks? What kind of reaction is used? Hydrolysis is just the reverse of the dehydration synthesis reaction. Good, so you should be able to do that. And then we talked about some amino acids, how they're very similar, and they're only different in one location right here, but that difference in this one location, which is R on this diagram, changes the function of that protein and of that amino acid pretty drastically, because sometimes it's an acidic group, sometimes it's a basic group, sometimes it's a nonpolar group, sometimes it's an ionic group, sometimes it can even form covalent bonds, like for instance the cysteine molecule can form covalent bonds between different locations within a protein, and that stabilizes the conformation of that protein in a very important and strong way. Okay, so this is going to be a figure that you have to draw in lab next time for extra credit, and that is how a peptide bond is formed. All right, so that will just help you writing some of these structures out, so I think everybody will be able to remember what the structure of a general amino acid is, and you'll probably see, maybe for the first time, why we call it an amino acid, because this NH2 group is the amino group on this molecule, and the CO2H, that's the acidic group on this molecule, and hence that is what an amino acid. Okay, and again, what do you have right here? This is a dehydration synthesis reaction. Okay, so we want to talk, yes?
Is there a reason why the second and fourth compared to the first
one? Yeah, you know what? We don't necessarily get into this, but it's because of the isomeric form. Some of these molecules can twist around, so some of these functional groups like this OH and this double bond O right here can be twisted around, and if they're not on the correct side, then they won't work properly in our body. There's an L form and a D form, okay, and so I think that's probably kind of important, okay. Yeah, so match it up just like that. And then what else do you notice? That the R group then is going to be on opposite sides in this chain. And remember that a protein is made up of amino acids, and that protein will be spelled correctly, will only have the proper function in your body if the correct amino acid sequence is produced, right? So the spelling of that protein has to be exactly right. And there are about 20 commonly available amino acids in your body. All right, so if a protein, so we talked about structure of a protein. How do we understand structure? There are different levels of structure of a protein. There's primary structure, secondary structure, tertiary structure. Anybody remember what primary structure was? It's just how a protein is spelled out, just the sequence of amino acids, okay? So what amino acid goes in the first position, what specific amino acid goes in the second and third and fourth, right? And that's got to repeat itself maybe 100 times, maybe even much more than that. Okay, so the primary structure is just a sequence of amino acids that make up that protein chain. It's a polymer of amino acids. And because of that primary structure, it's going to take a certain kind of twisting pattern or a folding pattern. And here's the twisting pattern. We call that an alpha helix. So there might be regions within the protein that form this alpha helix. It kind of looks like a spiral staircase right here. Another common form is what we call beta pleated sheet, and that kind of looks like an accordion. So it's just going to be very sharp lines, okay? And so that's the secondary structure. And what determines a secondary structure? Yeah, the primary structure. So primary structure is fundamental to secondary structure. All right, plus we want to also include then tertiary structure. So all of these twists and bends in a protein will then determine what its overall three-dimensional shape is, right? And we call that the conformation, and that is, of course, very important for the function of this particular protein, because if you change the shape of this protein, then you denature it, but then it also loses its activity. Okay, and proteins can be denatured by heat, by pH, by drastic changes in salt concentration. Okay, can cause these bends to change, And one thing about denaturation is that after a protein is denatured, it can't go back to its normal native configuration. So it's an irreversible process. We did talk about that. I think we talked about a hamburger that I consumed on Tuesday, that the protein that's raw looks a whole lot different than the hamburger that's cooked. But if you don't have time to eat your cooked hamburger and you put it back in the refrigerator to get cold again, just like the raw hamburger, it will never look like a raw hamburger again ever, because we have denatured all of those proteins. And I said there's one exception of that rule that I'm aware of. There might be more, but can anybody think of an exception to that rule where you can denature a protein, but then later renature it, get it back to its original conformation? And I said it had something to do with these disulfide bonds right here. Okay, what kind of bond is this disulfide bond? Strong, covalent, right? So it's a covalent bond, so it really stabilizes this protein. So the process I'm thinking about actually breaks this bond and makes it form in some other location within the protein. Okay, and I said when that happens, there's kind of like a sulfur smell, and you can see why, because that's here are a couple of sulfur groups. And that is when somebody gets a permanent in their hair. Okay. First, all of these disulfide bridges are broken down in your hair, which then straightens the hair out, and then probably hair is put into some kind of form, a curly form or something, and then these disulfide bridges are reformed, and somebody then has, you know, a different kind of curly hair. All right, so that's a denatured protein, but what can you do with a permanent? You can take it out. I don't know how that's done, but beauticians know how to do that, right? And so that is renaturation of those hair proteins. That's the only time that I know that it's not an irreversible process. All right, so be aware of these different bonds that can stabilize the tertiary structure of a protein and what level of strength they are. Like covalent is the strongest. Hydrogen is what? Hydrogen bonds are almost the weakest. Really close to being the weakest. But what is the weakest? Yeah, the van der Waals forces. And some people might not even call those bonds, but to me a bond is anything that brings atoms or molecules together, right? And since these are both nonpolar groups, that forms a little environment right here where they do attract each other. That's a very weak kind of bond. Okay, and in this particular case, we did talk about this. There's an important protein in our body, and it's called hemoglobin, and hemoglobin has four subunits, four different proteins that join together, and of course these proteins have to have a really nice specific shape so they fit together just perfectly, and if you change the shape of any of these, then this quaternary structure can't form, and then your body can't transmit or carry oxygen to parts of your body that need that oxygen. All right, so not only does the tertiary structure have to be proper in each of these four subunits so that they come together in just the right way, but also because each one of these subunits right here has to bind a heme group with iron in it, right? And so there has to be a special location on the interior of this protein to allow that molecule to fit in there, right? So there's all kinds of reasons why we can't change the shape of a protein. And I think I mentioned that there is a disease process, right? There is a congenital abnormality where there is a change in just one amino acid in hemoglobin, okay, and it drastically changes the form of hemoglobin so much that it changes the shape of a red blood cell, changes it from a nice disc shape which flows easily through capillaries into a shape of a cell that has a lot of points. It's long and narrow and a lot of points, and that red blood cell likes to get stuck in capillaries and form all kinds of microocclusions in tissue all over a person's body, in their brain and in their muscles, kidneys, everything else like that. And if those tissues can't get oxygen, then they slowly die as a result of that. And I mentioned that was sickle cell anemia. Okay, and I think we could do an experiment in lab. I don't want to do it in lecture. We could do an experiment to allow you to experience what it's like for a person to be in sickle cell crisis. Okay. And I could put a blood pressure cuff on your arm, okay, and pump it up so no blood is entering your arm, and then have you exercise that arm, Okay? Maybe you can't imagine what that's like, but here's a way to imagine what that is like. Have you ever had a cramp in a muscle? Walking down the street, all of a sudden you get a cramp in this biceps right here. It just contracts because some little thing is wrong. It contracts, you're walking down the street, and you like roll up your sleeve and point that beautiful, big, bulging muscle out and be really proud of it. Say, hey, look at that biceps right there. Is that what you would do if you get a cramp? What's going to happen? What would you do? Oh, you're going to start breathing funny. You're going to start exercising, right? You might start pinching that muscle. You try to figure out anything you can do to get that muscle to relax, because why? Hurts like hell. Okay? So anytime you cut off a blood supply to a muscle that's exercising, it hurts like hell. And so that's basically what people in sickle cell crisis feel, all right? Not just in one muscle, but what? All over their body. All right, so another point quickly that I want to make is, what do we do for patients that are in that kind of pain that just won't go away? What can you do for somebody that's in that intractable pain, the severe pain? Well, give them opiates, right? So that is a way to relieve that pain. Fortunately, opiates do work for that condition. So a lot of times, patients that have sickle cell disease will need to be treated with opiates, and they might come to a clinic or a place that you're working and request opiates, and usually the first thing that pops into a physician's mind is this a drug seeker? Okay, because you're always concerned. You never know what a drug seeker is going to do, if they're going to hurt you, if they can't get drugs that they need, right? But somebody in sickle cell crisis, don't treat as just somebody that has developed a dependency on narcotics, right? Because they need those narcotics just to be normal, right? So don't treat anybody like that as a chemical dependent kind of person, right? They are chemically dependent, but they have no choice. They have to be treated with opiates. Okay, so that just says a small change in the structure of a protein can have what? Drastic effects on somebody's life and how their body functions. Okay. All right, so what's the building block of tertiary structure or quaternary structure? Okay, I blew it. All right. So just remember that hierarchical organization of structure in a protein. And, you know, I might ask you on an exam. I might give you a structure and ask you what kind of structure that is. Is it primary, secondary, tertiary, or quaternary structure? Or I could show you a picture and then ask you what the building block is for that particular structure. Okay, here is a list of some important proteins that are in your body. Hemoglobin, we just got done talking about. Right, it does have a heme group that's a non-protein component buried deep within the molecule, and there are four polypeptide chains necessary to make hemoglobin, and it carries oxygen in the blood. And then since muscles need a lot of oxygen to produce ATP because they're using up ATP, there has to be a molecule that will accept that oxygen and act as a reservoir for oxygen inside of a muscle. We call that myoglobin. It doesn't have four polypeptide chains, it just has one, but it does have a heme pigment. And if somebody's breaking down muscle for whatever reason, this myoglobin then is no longer in the muscle cell, but it's released to the blood, and it's relatively easy to measure, but that myoglobin also causes kidney damage if it's in the blood. It can actually cause the death of a kidney, and so that's kind of a serious condition. When somebody starts to break down muscle, maybe because of severe exercise that they voluntarily choose to do. Okay, insulin has two polypeptide chains. That's for regulation of glucose in your body. Okay, blood group proteins have carbohydrates attached to them. And so we're going to start looking at some organelles inside the cell. Where that happens is in a Golgi body. Because Golgi body receives proteins from rough endoplasmic reticulum, and in the Golgi body they're modified somehow by conjugating with could be a lipid or a carbohydrate, in this particular case a carbohydrate, and then they're exported to the outside of a cell with a secretory vesicle. And a really good example of that would be, for instance, a mucopolysaccharide, or mucus is also a conjugated protein that has a sugar group on it. And also Golgi apparatus can make lipoproteins, can take a protein and add a lipid molecule to it And these things are important because they act like a detergent in your body, because the lipid doesn't like to dissolve in water, but the protein does. And so here is a molecule that can bind to a polar compound, but yet allow it to dissolve in blood, because the carrier protein has a significant part of it as a polar compound. Okay. All right, so that takes us to our last kind of biological molecule, nucleic acid. And does anybody know what the building block of nucleic acid is? It's a nucleotide, right? And how would you, so a nucleic acid is just a long string of nucleotides put together, just like a polysaccharide is a long chain of monosaccharides put together, and a protein is just a long chain of amino acids put together. How would you make a nucleic acid from its building blocks, namely nucleotides? How would you do that? How does your body do that? Not necessarily you, but how does your body do that? What kind of reaction is used? Dehydration synthesis reaction. That's right. Body didn't have to invent a new kind of reaction. Just uses the same one over and over again. And if there is a nucleic acid in your body that should be destroyed, maybe it has come from a bacteria or a virus or something like that, how would your body get rid of that nucleic acid? What kind of reaction would your body use to destroy that nucleic acid? Hydrolysis reaction. Our bodies are just loaded with enzymes that are designed to do that, because we don't want those nucleic acids in our body trying to take over the nucleic acids that are in the nucleus of our cells. Okay, they're called restriction enzymes. All right, so nucleic acids. Here is the basic structure of a nucleotide. It has a 5-carbon sugar. That 5-carbon sugar could either be a ribose or a deoxyribose. That's a 5-carbon kind of sugar. And we've only looked at what kind of sugar so far? 6-carbon sugars. Yeah, we've talked about glucose, which is 6, fructose, which is 6, galactose, which is 6. But ribose is a 5-carbon sugar. Right? And attached to this 5-carbon sugar on one end is a phosphate group. Right? On the other one, on the other end of this molecule, is a base, right? A molecule that is basic. And there are 4 different kinds of bases that we can find in DNA, okay? And the bases are guanine, thymine, cytosine, and adenine. But the rest of the molecule is exactly the same. So these different nucleotides are different only in the base that they contain. And on this diagram, you can see some are large groups, like guanine and adenine. Some are relatively small groups. Thymine and cytosine, and we're going to see why the size of these things and shape of these things is important. Okay, so here is that long polymer of nucleotides joined together with a dehydration synthesis type reaction. Okay, oh, I talked about this already. Okay, let's see. Okay, so this is why DNA is always found as a double strand. Here we see just a single strand of DNA. And I know this is DNA because, and not RNA, because DNA has a thymine base. RNA will never have a thymine base. It's going to have something called uracil right there. So even if you just look at a single strand, you can tell if it's DNA or RNA. DNA usually is going to exist in a double strand, so there's going to be another strand over here. And it's going to be complementary in shape to the bases that are on the left-hand side. So let's see how the bases pair up. Guanine and cytosine pair up because guanine is a relatively large functional group, and cytosine right here is kind of small, so they fit together. They match up. Plus, also, the number of hydrogen bonds is 3 for both of these. Right? The pairing for thymine and adenine, again, adenine is large, thymine is small. They fit together on the interior of a DNA molecule, but now you only have 2 hydrogen bonds. All right, so that's why base pairing is always what we call GC and AT, standing for these bases, because of the number of hydrogen bonds and the shape of these bases allows for this double helix, okay, which we call an alpha helix, to form. All right, so the other thing I want you to see right here is how strong are these hydrogen bonds? Hydrogen bonds. What's the strongest kind of bond? Covalent. What's the next strongest? Ionic. And then what's pretty weak? Hydrogen. So hydrogen bonds are pretty weak. So what about this molecule here, this DNA that has two strands that are joined together with hydrogen bonds? Is that a really stable molecule that's hard to break apart, or is it relatively easy to break apart? It's easy to break apart. And indeed, all day long, your cells that are active are breaking these bonds, unzipping these two separate strands of DNA to get at the sequence of nucleotides right here, and then it's put back together, right? Because it's easy to form hydrogen bonds. So a DNA molecule zips and unzips very easily, and there are enzymes that do that. They're like unzipperases and zipperases. They're not really called that, but you could think of them that way. Okay. The basic structure of DNA, you see, is double-stranded, and if we ignore the twist, it kind of looks like a ladder, right? And the steps of the ladder are made by the bases that stick to the interior of this molecule, and the handrails of the ladder, what makes up the handrails? What is called here the backbone. What are the handrails of this ladder? Go back and look to the, what is a nucleotide made of? Phosphate group and 5-carbon sugar. Okay, so what do we have right here? Phosphate group, 5-carbon sugar. Phosphate group, 5-carbon sugar. Over and over and over again. That's what makes up the handrail. And this 5-carbon sugar right here, is that a ribose sugar or a deoxyribose sugar, if this is DNA? Deoxy, which means that it's missing oxygen in just one part of the molecule. That's what makes DNA a deoxyribonucleotide different than a ribonucleotide. This slide also demonstrates what the base pairing rules that we see in DNA. So when I look at this picture right here, I can tell this is DNA for two reasons. Number one, it has thymine, and number two, it is double-stranded. Nice characteristics of DNA. Okay, RNA. Okay, is a little bit different, but it is still made up of nucleotides. So the basic building blocks of RNA are almost identical. The language of RNA and DNA is basically the same because the letters are almost identical. So what is the big difference? Here is a ribose molecule. Okay, it's just a 5-carbon sugar. Kind of looks like glucose a little bit, but it's just missing one carbon. There are OHs on each of these carbons right here. And on ribose, we have truly an OH group in this position. Right, for deoxyribose, look what the difference is. There's no OH group, there's only a hydrogen in that location. And that small change in this whole big molecule makes all the difference. So small changes in structure can mean what? Large changes in function inside your body. Right, so deoxyribose is missing that oxygen. The other thing is, in RNA, we said we don't have thymine, we have a little modified thymine that we call uracil. Almost has the same shape, but this uracil is just a little bit smaller because it doesn't have that methyl group. And again, it's kind of a small change, but it makes all the difference in the world. All right, so that's RNA, some differences between DNA and RNA. RNA usually is single-stranded. It might form some bends, and then there might be a small region where there is a double stranding, there is some base pairing going on, but overall the molecule is going to be single-stranded, DNA is going to be double-stranded. And there are a number of different kinds of RNA inside your body. There are three basic types that we're going to talk about. Okay, and this RNA is going to be used to make a protein. And what's the basic building block of a protein once again? Amino acids. Right, so in order to make a protein, we need this RNA, and that RNA has to bring amino acids to the workbench that's going to build a protein. And that kind of RNA is called tRNA, standing for scientifically transfer RNA. Transfer RNA floats around inside the cell everywhere, looking for an amino acid to bring to the workbench where it's going to be put into a protein. So sometimes I think of that as a taxi RNA, right, because it's just giving amino acids a ride in the cell to their proper location. The workbench where a protein is made from ribosomal RNA. So our RNA makes a ribosome, and maybe from anatomy, you remember that the function of a ribosome is to make a protein, right? So our RNA doesn't really know how to spell out a protein, what amino acids go next to each other in a long chain of amino acids, but it can put them together if it gets it from the tRNA with some instructions. And the instructions are contained in the messenger RNA. Messenger RNA has the proper sequence of nucleotides that can determine the proper sequence of amino acids in a protein. So all three of these work together to make a proper protein. RNA is the workbench, tRNA brings in amino acids, and the way these amino acids are joined together is determined by the messenger RNA. All these things are joined together. I mean, that's all we have in this chapter. Okay. All right, so who's got... I know what I wanted to do. We do have a little extra time. Okay. So let's see how we're doing on our chemistry, okay, in terms of structure. And so what I'm going to do is put this away. So I'm going to end the show. And you could go to Blackboard, and you can download a video that's going to do what I'm doing in class. All right, but I'm just going to do it manually. And we call this the chemistry flash quiz right here. All right, I'm going to turn off the syllabus. We don't need the syllabus on there right now. So I'm going to look at one and one. All right, so let's practice some of these things. Chemistry flash quiz. All right, so I want to just make that really big. Okay, so what do I have right here? I have a blank slide. Okay, it looks kind of like a square, but it's just really a blank slide. This is just a rest station for you. You don't have to know anything about this slide. But the one after this, you should be able to analyze and tell me what's going on and what the name of this particular structure is. So we just got done talking about this. What is this? It has a 5-carbon sugar, it has a nitrogenous base, and it has a phosphate group. It's a building block for something. Oh, first the name. What's the name of this thing? It's a nucleotide. We have to be a little bit more specific because now you know two different classes of nucleotides. Which one is this? Is this a deoxy or is this a ribonucleotide? Okay, this is a ribonucleotide used to make what kind of material? RNA, right? So this is a ribonucleotide. You don't have to tell me which one. Okay, and you know it's a ribonucleotide because it has an oxygen in this position. So this is a ribonucleotide. That's what I would like for you to say here. And that's a building block of RNA. Okay. What do you think the next slide is? Rest station. Okay. Let's go on to the next one. What do we got right here? What is just highlighted? You don't have to tell me we got a nonpolar backbone of all these carbon atoms, but I do want you to know what that group is. That's a sulfhydryl group, right? Sulfhydryl. And remember, it can form disulfide bridges, which stabilize proteins, okay, in a very important and in a strong way with a covalent bond. So, sulfhydryl group, and then a rest station. And then what do we have here? Amino group, right? So an amino group. And, of course, you know that this thing right here participates in what kind of building block? Amino acid for protein. Yeah, so that's an important functional group. Amino. And then what is this right here? Carboxyl group. Does anybody know something about a carboxyl group? It is what kind of group? It's an acidic group, right? Because it can donate this proton right here to solution. And remember that the definition of an acid is any kind of molecule that can release protons into solution or donate protons into a solution. So this is an acidic group. And then we got a rest station. Okay, you need to rest up because we've got a lot of slides right here. What functional group is this? That's a phosphate group. Okay, phosphate group is also acidic because it can donate these protons to solution. And when it does, it leaves this end in an ionic form, which means that this end can dissolve in water pretty easily. And might participate in maybe your favorite lipid molecule. I see a big lipid region right here. And that would be what? A phospholipid. What is a phospholipid used for? Did we talk about that? Yeah, I think we did. Yeah, cell membranes, right? Okay. Okay, so the next one. What do we got? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. And this is just a nice linear chain, but it can also fold up on each other to form this cyclic structure right here. This is a monosaccharide. Right, just a monosaccharide. You could call it maybe a hexose if you wanted. Hex because it has 6 carbons. But I want you to know this is a monosaccharide. And what is this used for? Yeah, to make a polysaccharide. Okay. And if it's glucose, it's used to make glycogen in our bodies, right? So it's a basic building block of polysaccharides. You don't have to tell me if it's galactose, fructose, or glucose. Just know that it is a monosaccharide. All right, what is this fancy thing? It's a fatty acid, right? Because here is that big nonpolar region, which makes it very fatty, doesn't like to dissolve in water. Here's that acidic group that we were just talking about. So this is a fatty acid. And it's a building block of something. Can anybody remember what it's a building block of? A triglyceride. You need three of these things joined to glycerol to make a triglyceride. And how would your body do that? What kind of reaction? Dehydration synthesis reaction. Exactly right. Oh, here it is right here. Didn't know it was the very next one. So what's going on right here? You just said it. Dehydration synthesis reaction. It's making a triglyceride, 1, 2, 3, right, from three fatty acids and a glycerol molecule, right? So you should know, you don't have to really be able to draw these fatty acids out or really memorize their shape, but probably a glycerol molecule would be really good for you to be able to draw out and know how it's all put together with three carbon atoms, right, three OH groups, and that when it interacts with three fatty acids, it can make a triglyceride with a dehydration synthesis reaction. Okay, that's important. How many carbons are in glycerol? Three, that's right, there are three. Okay, and if I wanted to know what the molecular weight, I got to go back. If I want to know what the molecular weight of glycerol is, how would I go about doing that? That's a question in the end of one of your chapters, calculating the molecular weight. So if we take an Avogadro number of these things and put them all in one spot, we have a mole of these things, what we call a mole, and it has a certain weight. How could we calculate what that weight is? Go to the periodic table and just look up the weight of each of these elements right here. I wouldn't use the atomic number. I would have to use the atomic mass, which is just a little bit different, right? And so you take the atomic mass of carbon, multiply it by 3 to get it for carbons, and then look up the atomic mass for oxygen, multiply it by 3, add that to what you calculated before, and then how many hydrogens? 6, 7, 8. And you'd multiply that by what number? Maybe you know, if you look at the periodic table, it's going to be 1, right? So 6 times 1, add those all together, and that would be the weight in grams of 1 mole of this particular substance right here. So just break the molecule down. That's why it's really good for you to know what the shape of this thing is and how these atoms are put together. Okay, rest station. And then we zip forward. What's this thing right here? Exactly what we saw before, monosaccharide, right? Used to make polysaccharides. This particular one just happens to be a fructose. And here is, what do we call this thing? Okay, I see phospholipids. That's one of the building blocks right here. But what is this overall structure? A micelle, right? So micelles form just automatically when these phospholipids are placed in water because of the dual nature of this molecule. Here is the polar end of the molecule. Here is the nonpolar end, right? And based on polarity, they like to associate with each other. So there are van der Waals forces right here that allow these nonpolar groups to join together, okay, to form this particular micelle. What is this little guy? That's a water molecule, right? That's just an H2O. And that just shows you that H2O associates with the phosphate head group of a phospholipid. Okay, and a phospholipid is the basic building block of what kind of thing? A membrane, a cell membrane. Okay, and I think we didn't officially talk about that yet in the class, but we got to get to it pretty soon. Okay, what kind of molecules are these? These are all steroids, right? Because I see that staircase step right here. The one on the top is cholesterol, and these down over here are just, most of them are sex steroids, sex hormones that we have in our body. All right, but a good answer here would be a steroid molecule. And what is this? Another fatty acid, but in this particular case, not every carbon has two hydrogens. These two right here are missing two, so we call this unsaturated fatty acid. And that changes the shape of this fatty acid. It's going to put some bends or kinks in it, and the bending and kinking will be different. Even though there's a double bond, for instance, if the hydrogens are on opposite sides of the molecule. Okay? So if there's a hydrogen here and a hydrogen here, but still a double bond, it's going to have a different kind of configuration, a different kind of shape, right? And that change in shape would be enough to be used as, for instance, what did we mention last time? A switch to turn certain things on or off. Because when you change the shape of something, you change the function inside the body. Okay. Ah, what's this? I see an amino group and an acidic group. This is just a general form of an amino acid. Okay. I don't think I'm going to ask you the name of any particular amino acids. But what do we got right here? Next slide. I see glycerol with two fatty acids, right? But on the third carbon over here, I don't see a fatty acid. I see a phosphatidyl group. I don't think you have to know that, but you see this phosphate group and this nitrogen group, which are highly polar, right? And these groups right here make up the polar head group in a phospholipid. These tails over here make up the nonpolar regions of a phospholipid. All right, so make sure you can identify a phospholipid when you see it like this, or if you see it like that. Okay. So those are some things. These are exam figures that I could put on the exam. Here's another exam figure. What do we got right here? Yeah, these are prostaglandins, and they're just modified fatty acids, as you can see. Just long hydrocarbon chains, prostaglandin. Okay, what do we got right here? Okay, alpha helix of a protein. And you could also say, I could also ask you, what kind of structure is that? Secondary structure. Or I could ask you, what is the building block of this unit right here? It is primary structure, which is, and then you should know that's just the sequence of amino acids. So there's a lot you could talk about in that slide. Now, what do we got right here? A phosphate group, five carbon sugar, and a nitrogenous base. That's a nucleotide. But you should probably know a little bit more than that. What kind of nucleotide is there? It's a deoxy because it's missing that oxygen. So we're going to be interested in two kinds of nucleotides. Well, at least for making DNA and RNA, there's two kinds of nucleotides, right? There's a deoxy form that we see right here and a ribo form which goes into RNA. Okay. Functional group is hydroxyl. And what's this molecule? Glycerol. And what do we got right here? That's a carbonyl group. Carbonyl group. And what do we have here? That's a ribonucleotide. You don't have to tell me which one, but here it's not deoxy because I see this oxygen. All right, so let's just go through this a little bit more quickly, right, just so that you can become a little bit more familiar with these molecules. I'm just going to ask you the name and not really analyze everything that these molecules do for us like we did before. So this is what I call a flash quiz. So don't blink because you'll miss the thing that you want to look at. All right, ready? Look at the screen. What's that? Sulfhydryl group. Sulfhydryl group. What's that? Amino group. What's that? That's a carboxyl group. All right, another one. A phosphate group. And what's that? That is a monosaccharide. Let's go back. Monosaccharide is just that six carbon sugar. All right, monosaccharide. Ready for the next one? Oops, that was too fast. But you know what? I bet some of you saw what it was. Okay, it was the mouse. It wasn't me. What is that? A nice fatty acid, right? It's a saturated fatty acid in particular. And maybe you know what the next one is. Ah, no, I guessed wrong. Okay, so here is what? A dehydration synthesis reaction or triglyceride formation from its building blocks, and you should know what those building blocks are. Okay, next one. What's that? Another monosaccharide, a little bit different one. You don't have to know that it's fructose. But indeed it is. That is a micelle. You should be familiar with how these micelles form, why they form, what's the basic building block, right? But if you can at least see that as a micelle, then you're learning some good language already. What are those?
Steroids.
What do we got here? Unsaturated fatty acid. Okay. And here is amino acid. Amino acid, and you should know that's a building block for a protein. What was that thing? Phospholipid, what's that a basic building block for? Cell membrane, plasma membrane, as a matter of fact, any kind of membrane that we have in our body. What are those? Those are all prostaglandins, modified fatty acids. And what is this right here? Secondary structure. Okay, and secondary structure is a building block of what? Aha, building block of. Okay. Ah, tertiary structure. Okay, I didn't ask what the building block of secondary structure was. I just asked what is the secondary structure of building block. I kind of went the other way, tried to just trick you just a little bit. Okay, what do we got right here? Deoxyribonucleotide, building block of RNA. And here, hydroxyl group. Here is glycerol, nice three-carbon molecule. That was that carbonyl group. All right, and then here we have a ribonucleotide because it has the oxygen in that one location. Here is sulfhydryl, and here is amino carbon. Oh, we looked at these already. Okay, coming back to me now. Ah, that's scary. All right, so you should be able to identify these in just really quick look. So I want to go through it one more time. If that motion is making you seasick, then you just have to look away or close your eyes. Okay, but hopefully nobody will get too seasick. All right, so I'm going to flash a structure on the screen, and you tell me what it is. Phosphate group. Monosaccharide. Yeah, what kind of fatty acid? Saturated fatty acid. Triglyceride synthesis, or you could say dehydration synthesis reaction. Another monosaccharide. Micelle. Steroids. Unsaturated fatty acid. Amino group. We can spend a lot of time on a rest station, that's okay. But on the real picture, we got to go fast. That's a phospholipid. Okay, next one. Prostaglandin. You can see where prostaglandins come from, namely fatty acids. Secondary structure. What's the building block of secondary structure? Primary. And secondary structure is a building block of? Tertiary structure. Nice. What was that? Oh, that was a little quick. Okay, that was a deoxyribonucleotide. Okay. Deoxyribonucleotide. And here is hydroxyl group. Here is glycerol. Here is, that's a carbonyl. What was that? That was a ribonucleotide because it had the oxygen, not deoxy, but that was a ribonucleotide. What is it a building block of? What's a ribonucleotide a building block of? RNA. Yeah, RNA, and some forms of RNA are used to make a ribosome, which is the workbench for protein synthesis. Okay, next one. Sulfhydryl. Amino, carboxyl, phosphate, monosaccharide, saturated fatty acid. Okay, you guys are getting really good. Too bad we can't make a practical exam out of that. Okay, because if you had to spend a whole minute at a station answering that, you'd be really bored, right? So if you can answer that in just a split second, you're going to have a lot of fun on the lecture exam. Yeah. You know, triglyceride, because of glycerol, it has partial water solubility, but it's still really a lipid. It's more lipid soluble than water soluble. Okay. Yeah. All right, so that's chemistry. Does anybody have any questions on chemistry? I don't have these individual slides in Blackboard for you, but I did make a video of that, and so you can practice that at home. Okay. And so it's sort of an interactive video because I show you the picture and then you have to say the name of what you see before I say it, right? And then you say the name out loud. If it's exactly what I say, that's good, right? If it's a different name, then you got to go back and see why you missed it. Okay, question.
So fatty acids have the carboxyl group on the very end.
That's exactly right. That's the acidic group, hence fatty acid. Go ahead.
In the rest of the hydrocarbon chain,
it can be modified, all right, but then it's no longer a fatty acid. It's something else.
So fatty acids, the chains are always...
They're always going to be hydrocarbons. Yeah. And if that chain, hydrocarbon chain is modified, then usually it's turned into some kind of signaling compound, signaling molecule, like prostaglandin, for instance. So fatty acid can be used as a building block for more than just triglycerides. Okay, and it can also help control things. If it's modified in a certain way, it can control processes inside the cell. But we won't get to talk about that for probably a couple months yet. Okay. But I do want to mention something that is sort of interesting. Let's see, how far away is a micelle? Okay, don't look up, because I don't want you to get seasick by looking at all this silly motion right here. Maybe you're naming all these things as I flash by. Ah, here's a micelle. Okay, so on this slide, I want to point out that there are basically two worlds inside your body. And it will make more sense when we get toward the end of this class. And this slide right here kind of demonstrates the two worlds. You probably all saw this movie called Waterworld, okay? And so here I see Waterworld, right, with all these water molecules and polar compounds. That's the major part of your body. But what's another world inside your body? It's really small. It is lipid world, okay? And we see that lipid world is made up of mostly these fatty acids. We're going to have to talk about lipid world later on in this class. Mostly we're going to talk about water world over here, these polar compounds, okay? Because things happen in this region of the membrane that are real important, okay? Even though it's very small and totally different than what we see in the rest of your body. Okay. All right, so where does that take us to? Did I close the syllabus down? That's chapter 6, right? Oh, I know why we can't see it. Because we're not like this. All right, so we're going to talk about some interactions between cells and their environment. Unless there are some questions about chemistry. Any questions about chemistry? No. So don't forget what you learned about those nucleic acids and proteins, because we're going to talk about how they interact to make a protein sometime real soon. All right, so let's find some more lecture material. Okay. So I'm going to give you a good orientation here for this chapter. So let's start the slideshow. Let's make the cursor behave. Nice. Then get the display mode so you don't have to bend your neck too much. Okay, so in this chapter, we're going to look at the extracellular environment first. We're going to look at the structure of a plasma membrane and why things can move across the membrane and why they can't. And that's real important because everything on the inside of the plasma membrane is a living system. Everything on the outside is not living. Right, so we got to see how these two things interact with each other. We're going to talk about membrane transport systems. And we're going to see that a cell membrane is an important electrical factory for us. And we're going to see that we're very electrical beings. And we'll talk about some cell signaling as well. Okay, so let's concentrate on the extracellular environment. And what is the extracellular environment? It's the space inside you, but outside of cells. So there is a large part of you that has no cells. It's just the extracellular space. And you probably remember there's a tissue that has a lot of extracellular material. And as a matter of fact, that particular tissue is determined, the characteristics of that tissue is determined by what's the junk outside the cell, not what's inside the cell. Anybody remember what kind of tissue that is? Where the extracellular space is so important? It is a connective tissue, right? Connective tissue. The cells are far apart, and there's a big space between the cells. Who can remember what the name of that space is called? It's called the matrix, right? In a connective tissue, it's a matrix. Maybe some of that is ringing a bell. If not, go and back and read some of the other parts of chapter 1. Okay. All right, so the extracellular environment constitutes all the space, okay, outside of cells in your body. But it's broken down into a couple of different regions that we should be familiar with. Right, the intracellular compartment, that's inside the body, right, which is 67% of you, contains water. That's inside the cell, right? So 67% of water is inside cells. The remaining is outside a cell. So about a third of your body, a third of your water is outside of your cell. Furthermore, if we can, and we call that the extracellular compartment. And furthermore, we could break that down into two main regions. So let's just consider that extracellular compartment to be 100%. Let's break it down into its constituents. 80% of extracellular fluid, that's what ECF stands for, that F is fluid, 80% of extracellular fluid is interstitial fluid. It's contained in a gel-like matrix. And what kind of tissue has that gel-like matrix? It's a connective tissue. So connective tissue holds a lot of water in our body, right? And sometimes we call that ground substance, right? Ground substance is that jelly-like material in the matrix of a connective tissue. I should just ask you this just for fun. All right, so the matrix is made up of two major components. One is this jelly-like material, which we call ground substance. What's the other part of a matrix in a connective tissue? Anybody remember? It's fibers, right? It's fibers like collagen, elastic fibers, reticular fibers, right? So that's what makes up a matrix in a connective tissue. And 20% of all the extracellular fluid is blood plasma. And what about blood? What kind of tissue is blood? It's a connective tissue. It's kind of a strange connective tissue because the matrix is a fluid, right? It's a fluid, so it can flow through different parts of your body. And one of the reasons why it's a fluid because it contains a lot of water, about 20% of the extracellular space. Right? There are proteins dissolved in blood, which are, well, like I said, they're dissolved in blood, so they're not really fibers. They exist, they're fibers, but they exist in a soluble form. Collagen in connective tissues is an insoluble material, so it forms a thread or a fiber. But one interesting thing about blood, if the circumstances are right, those soluble fibers can precipitate out and actually become things like collagen and elastic fibers. And it can form a net, right, very rapidly. And the importance of that net that forms is that when you have damage to a blood vessel, that net forms very rapidly and it kind of seals over that cut so that you don't suffer blood loss as a result. So we call that blood clotting. That protein is what we call fibrin, right? All right, so there are thread-like materials in plasma, but usually they're in solution. They don't precipitate out unless there's damage to a blood vessel wall. All right, so here we see, I see a layer right here, okay, I see a free space with nothing above it, and that's characteristic of a particular kind of tissue. But before we name this, I think I probably should have asked you, what are the major kinds of tissues in your body? What do you got? I think maybe I asked last time. What are the major tissues? How many are there? There's only four. Four major kinds of tissues. What are they? Connective tissues, one. Epithelium is one, muscle is one, and nervous tissues, so only those four. All right, so on this slide, I see a couple interesting tissues. I see this line of cells right here, and that's a particular kind of tissue, and here's that free space above it. All right, so that is an epithelium, and you could probably characterize that epithelium. Who could tell me what kind of epithelium is this? I hear simple, yeah, because it's only one cell layer thick, and what else do you need to tell me? The shape of the cells, and these are cuboidal. So it's a simple cuboidal epithelium on this particular slide. All right, so I did want you to just analyze that a little bit. And then here is the basement membrane, which we find on all epithelium, that helps join the epithelium here to underlying structures. It could be blood vessels, could be muscle, could be bone, for instance. All right, in this particular diagram, okay, this probably maybe looks like skin because I see some collagen fibers over here. Here's a cell that secretes those collagen fibers into the matrix, so we would call that a fibroblast. All right, is this coming back a little bit to you? All right, but now here is a blood vessel, a special kind of blood vessel, because I see fluid diagrammed right here leaving this blood vessel into this interstitial space, interstitial fluid. Does anybody know what kind of blood vessel that is? We looked at it in anatomy. Didn't talk about its function too much, just a little bit. Okay, but now we're in physiology, so we should really know the name of this and what its function is. This indeed is a capillary. And you could identify this as being a capillary because the wall is very thin, right? Arteries and veins have very thick walls, and that does not allow material to move in and out of the blood. Arteries and veins don't allow for any motion between tissue spaces and the blood, only capillaries because they're so thin. And some of them even have little pores in them, like I see right here. Okay, this ground substance is made of glycoproteins. What kind of compound is a glycoprotein? It's part protein and part sugar, okay? And that forms the spongy material that can hold a lot of water. These fibers can be collagen, they could be elastic proteins right here. Those are the two of the three kinds of fibers in a connective tissue. And don't forget, blood itself is a connective tissue. Right, it has a cellular compartment, which would be analogous to this fibroblast, right? But it also has, the matrix is what we call plasma. And it has dissolved proteins in it, just like the ground substance of other kinds of connective tissues. Right, so ground substance is made up of a meshwork of various fibers, like collagen, elastic fibers, reticular fibers. And it does contain that ground substance, which we talked about, which are glycoproteins, for instance, or proteoglycans is another way of talking about a protein that has been conjugated with a sugar molecule. Okay, that's all I need to say about this. But in this ground substance, how much water of all the extracellular fluid, how much water is contained in this ground substance right here? 20%. Okay, so that's how important it is. And things can move through water pretty easily. And that's why it is here. So material can move from this blood vessel through this water space to these cells right here, bringing nutrients or taking away waste products. And so that's why we have so much water in that extracellular fluid. Okay, let's talk about the plasma membrane and how we get things across the plasma membrane. So you remember what the basic shape of a plasma membrane or the basic structure of a plasma membrane is? I have it. It is what? What is this right here? Phospholipid. Here's another phospholipid. So a very good, easy description of a plasma membrane is a phospholipid bilayer. Okay, but remember there are proteins that are inserted into the plasma membrane that change the shape of that membrane, the structure of the membrane, the function of the membrane as a result. So here's a protein that changes the function of this particular membrane. So here is this internal region right here is the lipid world of a plasma membrane, and only polar compounds, right, can dissolve in this area, which means only polar compounds can move across the cell membrane. Right, what about sodium ion that has a plus charge on it? Is that polar or nonpolar? That's a polar molecule because it has that electrical charge. It likes to dissolve in water, and you kind of know that because you could put table salt in water and it's going to dissolve very easily. So something like sodium can't move across the cell membrane because it can't get past this polar region. Right? So sodium, if it's inside the cell, it's stuck. Sodium, if it's outside the cell, it's stuck, can't get through this polar region of a cell membrane. So only lipid molecules can move through a plasma membrane. All right, so let's go back to this slide right here. Okay, transport across the plasma membrane. A plasma membrane is selectively permeable. It only allows certain kinds of molecules to pass through that. So sometimes we say selectively permeable, sometimes we say semi-permeable, and that means exactly the same thing. And I might use both terms in the same sentence even. Okay, so beware of that. What's another term for selectively permeable? Semi-permeable, which means some things can move through a membrane and some can't. Right, many important molecules have special transporters or channels through a plasma membrane because they are polar compounds. They can't move by themselves through a cell membrane. Sometimes we call it a carrier-mediated transport if it involves a specific transporter molecule. Maybe a molecule has to bind to something in the membrane before it's moved across. And then there are non-carrier-mediated transports. Maybe there's a special protein that forms a hole in the membrane, and that hole is what we call a channel. And that channel can be open all the time, or the cell can maybe open it sometimes, close it at other times, to allow molecules, for instance, like that sodium, to enter or leave the cell, right? Because sodium can't move across the membrane because it's a polar compound. Okay. Basically, there's two ways that molecules can move around inside of a cell or across a plasma membrane, and those are called passive and active. Passive transport and active transport. Passive transport just means that no energy is required. It's a process that will just happen automatically if left alone. Right, so it can move, and in order for it to be passive, compounds can only move down a concentration gradient. Okay, it just means that the concentration of that substance is high in one area, and then in another area, it is what? It's low. Right, so there's that's what we mean by a gradient. It means it's high in one region, low in another. If you draw a line between those two on a graph, you're going to see what, like a gradient between them. So things for passive transport can only move, and this is not on the slide, but it's probably a good idea to write it down. For passive transport, molecules can only move from high to low, just like that. Okay. Active transport, on the other hand, requires energy. What's your favorite molecule for energy? I was going to say glucose because you have that in milkshakes, but indeed, you all know it is ATP, right? It is ATP. So active transport requires ATP, and it can move things not from high concentration to low, but from low concentration to high, right? And that requires energy to do that. It can move compounds against the concentration gradient. It can push molecules up that gradient, right, from low concentration to high. And it's usually going to require ATP. Okay, let's just talk a little bit more about some physical chemistry before we really get into this topic. What the heck is a solution? Maybe some of you know what a solution is, right? But let's define it very particularly. It has two parts. It has two parts. What are the two parts? The solvent and the solute, right? The solvent is just the liquid part of this system, this solution. And the solute is a little particle, okay, that is dissolved within the solvent. So you could have maybe two liquids like water and alcohol, they mix together, and you would know which one is the solvent because it's just going to be the majority molecule. And the other is going to be the solute because there isn't as much in that particular solution. Okay, so in that particular case, alcohol would be the solute. But other kinds of solutes you might be working with day in and day out. Like you might take some sodium chloride, put that in water, those ionic bonds are going to dissociate, and sodium and chloride will dissolve in that water. In that particular case, water is the solvent, and the solutes are the sodium ion and the chloride ion. Could you tell me what kind of ion sodium is? How many charges does it have? Plus one, which means it is what? A monovalent cation. What about chlorine? It is a monovalent anion. Yeah, so don't forget about those things. All right, so what have you used as a solvent today? You might have a number of different kinds of solvents. What kind of solvent have you used today? Okay, I heard some answers, but I couldn't quite make any of them out. Who's got maybe a good thought? What's a good example of a solvent that you use today? Water, for instance. And what did you dissolve in that water?
Juice.
Yeah, like orange juice, okay? And some people maybe took coffee, dissolved that in water to make coffee. Some people eat coffee grounds, but that's not the way I like to have coffee. I like to have coffee, what, dissolved in water, okay? All right, so the solvent is water, and then the solutes are those things like the orange particles and the coffee particles that dissolve in that solvent. All right, so what solutes have you used today? Well, we just said some particles of orange, maybe tea particles or coffee particles. Maybe you like coffee with sugar in it, and that sugar then becomes a solute that's dissolved in water as well. All right, so what's the major solvent in your body? What's the major solvent in your body?
Water,
exactly right. And we talked about the different compartments that water is located in, right, in the extracellular fluid and plasma, for instance. Right. What are some important solutes in your body?
Sodium,
cation, chloride anion. How about ATP? adenosine triphosphate. Yeah, that's a solute. It dissolves in the water, and you got to have ATP in your body, otherwise you just won't be alive. Right, glucose, amino acids, proteins, right? All those things are solutes dissolved in water in your body. What are some important solutes? Oh, we just talked about that. What is a minor solvent in your body? What is another kind of solvent where other kinds of things can dissolve in it? I mentioned it just in passing just a couple minutes ago, right? And it's a place where water can't exist, and that is lipid world, right? So lipids can be considered like a minor solvent in your body because lipid-soluble compounds can dissolve in that lipid environment. For instance, you might have cholesterol or steroids in your body. They don't really like to dissolve in water, but they can dissolve in the lipid regions of your body. Okay, there are vitamins that are lipid-soluble, and they can dissolve in your fat deposits, right? And very rarely are they found, right, in the water compartments of your body. And that's actually pretty important because water-soluble vitamins you can't overdose on because they're easily excreted in your body, in urine. Whenever you pee out all kinds of vitamins, for instance, like vitamin C. Other kinds of vitamins, like vitamin A, can become toxic because it's a fat-soluble vitamin. It's going to dissolve in your fat in our side of our bodies, and it's very difficult for your body to get rid of, right? So the kidneys can't just do that. So those kinds of vitamins can be toxic. So it's nice to be able to see those things. Okay, what can dissolve in this minor solvent? Ooh, I gave you some examples. What's the minor solvent once again? Lipid. What can dissolve in lipid? Any kind of nonpolar compound, right? And a specific example would be, for instance, any kind of steroid. And, for instance, like vitamin A, vitamin D would be solutes that because they're lipid-soluble compounds. Okay. All right, so we worked with this idea of what a solution is. It's got these two parts. All right, so let's talk about one way that things can move around. And this first way is what we call diffusion. Diffusion is a passive way that something can move around, which means what in terms of ATP? Does it need ATP? No. It also means something else. How is it going to move? It's going to move from high concentration to low concentration. All right, so here we see a diagram. We have one container with a little separation between them, right? And on the left side, we see a high concentration of some kind of solute. And on the right, we have a low concentration. And if we turn our back on this thing, something's going to happen. These particles then are going to move from left to right, from high concentration to low. Some of these particles on the right are going to move to the left, but not enough, right, to counteract how many move from left to right. So the net movement is going to be from left to right, going from high concentration to low concentration. And that's exactly how we're going to understand diffusion. Things move from high concentration to low. And after a long period of time, what's the concentration of these particles going to be on either side of this dotted line? They're going to be equal. And I see that over here. And if the concentration is equal, what can you tell me about diffusion? That's another step you have to take. It's going to stop, right? You're going to have motion going to the right. You're going to have motion of these particles to the left, but they're going to exactly cancel out. There's not going to be any net motion, right? Let's think of another example. I have a perfume bottle in my hand. And there's no perfume molecule in the room like what I have in my hand. Right, I'll open up the top and some of that perfume is going to evaporate into the air. Right, and a lot of that perfume is going to evaporate in the air. And so there's going to be a high concentration here, but zero concentration in the back of the room. What's going to happen to that perfume molecule? It's going to move, right? And it's not going to require any energy, right? And you said that's called diffusion. It will diffuse. It will diffuse from this area of high concentration to area of low concentration. So people in the front row will smell it first, people in the second row next, and next, and next, and next, and next, okay? And it's going to then move throughout the whole room, even though there's no fan blowing it around, right, or nothing. It will just happen automatically. Okay, so let's pretend we're going to spend the weekend in here, and we're going to close the doors, And then we're going to wake up Tuesday morning, and we're going to look at those perfume molecules. What can you tell me about those perfume molecules? Concentration in the back, be exactly the same as the front, okay? Because it has had time to diffuse. Now, when the concentration is the same in the back and the front of that perfume molecule, is any diffusion going to take place? No, it's going to stop because there's no concentration gradient. And as a matter of fact, the speed of how things move is determined by the magnitude of that gradient. If there's a small gradient, it kind of moves slowly. If there's a big gradient, it moves fast. So you might be wondering, what the heck is stirring these molecules up if we don't have a fan on or something? Okay? And that's because every molecule that I see right here and in your body has a certain motion. If it was at absolute zero, all motion in that molecule would stop. And I don't think anybody's ever attained absolute zero. Does anybody know what temperature absolute zero is? I keep forgetting. It's like minus 273 degrees Celsius. Really, really, really cold. It's okay. So at that theoretical temperature, all motion of molecules stop. But as the temperature increases, guess what happens to those molecules? They start to wiggle and bend or vibrate or do something, okay? And as the temperature increases, then so does that motion, that vibration or bending or twisting, right? And so that's the stirring motion that happens. We call that Brownian motion, okay? And that's the stirring motion that allows for diffusion to take place because all of those molecules in our body are like little motors, kind of stirring themselves up because we're not at absolute zero. Okay. Okay, on this slide, do you see ATP anywhere? No. Which means what? Is it active or passive transport? It's passive transport, right. Okay. Nonpolar compounds can readily diffuse through the cell membrane. We said that because it's a phospholipid bilayer, right? The lipid area inside a membrane does not allow polar compounds or ionic compounds to move across the membrane. Fortunately, carbon dioxide and oxygen can diffuse through the cell membrane very easily, or can move across the cell membrane very easily. So let's take a look at this example here. I see two tissue cells. Here's the extracellular environment. And I really don't see these colors really well. But here is a cell. Kind of looks the same as this one over here. Right, but this cell, this first one, needs oxygen to make ATP. Right, and there's oxygen in the atmosphere. So here's a good concept. Well, maybe oxygen is like these blue dots over here. Maybe. All right. So in the air, there's a high concentration of oxygen. Okay, and where is there a low concentration of oxygen? Don't forget, your cells need oxygen. Where is the low concentration of oxygen? It's inside the cell. Okay, even though your cells need oxygen, it's low inside the cells compared to the air, so oxygen will be able to diffuse from high concentration in the air to low concentration in the cell. All right, so oxygen gets in our body just due to this, what, passive mechanism. All right, what about CO2? Our cells produce CO2 when it uses oxygen and sugars, for instance, to make ATP. All right, so CO2 is inside the cell. There's also some CO2 in the air. Where is CO2 going to be at a high concentration in order for you to excrete it from your body? It's going to be high inside the cell, and it's pretty close to zero in the air, which means it's a huge concentration gradient. So carbon dioxide just loves to jump out of your body into this air over here, and it does that passively. All right, so we can excrete carbon dioxide just passively because that concentration gradient from inside the cell to the atmosphere or the air that we're breathing. Okay, so here is that diagram of a cell. So some compounds, like we saw, can move across the cell membrane. Other compounds can't, like sugars and ions can't move across the cell membrane. Here's that nice phospholipid bilayer that has some proteins associated with it. This one right here is a channel. But this channel can open and close depending on certain things that are happening inside the cell. So in this particular case, we could have something like an ion that could be a sodium, could be a calcium ion, could be a chloride ion, which has an electrical charge. It can't get through the cell membrane. And in this particular case, it still can't get through the membrane because this channel or this pore is closed. It has that conformation. This protein has this conformation. Right? But at certain times, it can change conformation, and now it becomes an open channel. And ions then can move across the membrane. We see some moving. But how are they going to move? With just a plain old channel right here. And the hint is, so here's extracellular, here's intracellular, or cytoplasm. Here's the hint. Do you see any ATP on this slide? No. No ATP. So we're looking at what kind of process, active or passive? Passive. So if this channel opens, okay, what has to be the case in order for this molecule, whatever it is, we said it's some kind of ion, to move across the cell membrane? It's got to be high concentration in one spot, low concentration in the other, and that's indeed, I see a lot of that ion on the extracellular side, very little on the inside, so this ion, it will move through this pore and enter the cell. And since it's an ion, what does an ion have that's special? It has a charge, right? Sometimes we call those electrolytes, right? And you might be able to, you might be asked to measure the lights of a patient very quickly, take a blood sample down to a lab to get their lights measured, and it's not something like a flashlight or something. It's what? Electrolytes in their body. So these electrolytes then move into the cell, and since they have electrical charge, guess what they change inside the cell? The electrical properties inside the cell. And we're going to look at those things a lot coming up. Okay, what time do we close end class here? 45. Okay, a couple minutes, like 4 minutes left. All right, so here's a channel that can change shape, and it can be a closed channel or an open channel, allowing charged molecules to move across. So we said diffusion does not require ATP. It's passive. Things move from high concentration to low. So, diffusion is directly related to the magnitude of the concentration gradient. Right. And it's related directly to the permeability of that compound through the cell membrane. Right? There's got to be a way this compound can get across. And also because it's directly related to temperature, because as you increase the temperature, what are we also increasing? If you think of one molecule, how fast it's bending and vibrating around, right? How fast it's mixing things up. So we call that directly related to the rate of diffusion. So we're looking at the rate of diffusion. And then also the surface area of the membrane. How big is the membrane? And as the membrane gets bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger, right and left, top to bottom, then more diffusion can take place, as opposed to a small membrane that's really, really small. Then things can only move through a really small surface area. Okay? And then the rate of diffusion is inversely related to molecular weight. And that is something we calculated for glycerol, for instance. That just tells us how heavy a particular molecule is. So you know what we need to do? We need to make this, turn this into an equation. Okay, so let's make an equation out of this thing so that you really have a good sense of what inversely related and directly related is. So we put diffusion right here, but what? Actually, the rate of diffusion. What is the rate of diffusion equal to? We got things where it's directly related. Sometimes it's inversely related. So we're going to look at a fraction. So put a nice dividing line right there. If it's directly related, it's in the numerator. If it's inversely related, it's in the denominator. Okay, so what did we have? We had concentration gradient, so I'll just put CG, right? I'm going to put that in the denominator. If we increase concentration gradient, what happens to the rate of diffusion? It increases, right? So I think probably everybody has an understanding of algebra to that level, right? What else? Permeability. So permeability of the membrane to that substance. If we increase the permeability, what happens to the rate of diffusion? Increases. Because how is it related? It's related directly. Directly related. Okay. And then also, what else do we need in the numerator here? Temperature is directly related. If we increase the temperature, it increases the rate of diffusion. And then the last one is surface area, right here. If we increase surface area, the rate of diffusion increases. Now, what about that last one, molecular weight? We said it's inversely related. Where do we put that? In the bottom, right? So here we got molecular weight. So if we increase the molecular weight, what happens to this fraction here? Okay, what if we have, one half and then compare it to, let's make that two bigger, like 16. So we have 1/16. Right, so you got 1/2 versus 1/16. Which one is smaller? 1/16, right? So as this number gets bigger, what happens to the rate of diffusion? It goes down, and that's why it's inversely related. I'm going to use that term just in natural everyday language speaking, so you've got to be able to track that in terms of this equation right here. Okay, time to quit, but we'll see you Tuesday. Oh, and don't forget, online assignments. Does anybody have trouble logging into Blackboard? I hope not. Okay. Really good. Hi.